to have this hearing, this joint ag and energy hearing. Hopefully we'll have a chance, Mr. Chair, to do these on some other occasions. I know we had a petroleum request, and there's a lot we can do about that. You know, my famous saying is ag is energy, and energy is ag. That's what I always say.
There's a lot of energy here in the room.
That's right. That's right.
Comedians do
something. a little stand-up comedy show here. But just real briefly, members, and we're waiting for a few more people, and I appreciate your patience. Transportation went just a little bit long, but February 28th, we're going to have the presentation from MISO, and Mr. Robert Bernstein, the Vice President of State Regulatory, from the Midwest Independent Operator, is going to be here, and we're going to have Senator Brown's bill, Senate File 1534, the wind easements, and that has been referred from the Ag Committee. And then on March 6th, we're going to have a hearing on nuclear power, so there will be something about that. I'll learn about the disaster in Japan and update on the Blue Ribbon Commission and a resolution urging the Congress to move forward with an interim. It's Senator Koch's bill. And then on March 8th, we're going to process the Renewable Development Fund bill. So just a little FYI there. If there's any other bills upcoming, like I said, Senate File 1534, the Brown's wind easement bill, and Senate File 1815 is Senator Brown's right of first refusal, and the RDF telecommunications. And if there's any others that are coming up or anybody has any ideas, please let's get them in. Senator Benson, do you have? Okay. So today, like I said, we have the Joint Ag and Energy Committee hearing on the trends in the natural gas industry. And we have Mr. Jeff Daugherty from the Director of Regulatory and Legislative Activities, and Chris McGill, the Managing Director of Policy Analysis of the American Gas Association. If both of you could come up, I sure would appreciate it. And please state your name. Record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Senators. My name is Jeff Daugherty. I'm the Director of Regulatory and Legislative Activities for CenterPoint Energy's Minnesota Gas Operations.
Welcome, Mr. Daugherty.
Good afternoon. Christopher McGill, Managing Director of Policy Analysis at the American Gas Association in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Mr. McGill. Mr. McGill is the Managing Director of the Policy Analysis for American Gas, as he said, and your work has been in the assessment of future supplies of natural gas production, unconventional gas operations, completion technologies, underground storage, key pipeline transportation issues, winter heating, season planning, and other topics in the industry. And so we have we should have a very lively discussion here. So thank you to you both for being here.
Thank you. Well, with that, Madam Chair, may I proceed? That'd
yes,
be helpful?
Please, Mr.
Okay.
Daugherty.
What I'm going to do, Madam Chair and Senators, is just do a little context and then quickly turn it over to Mr. McGill, who is truly the expert here on natural gas supplies in across the United States. I'd like to touch just on two items, if I may, and one is just briefly touch on the natural gas delivery process and give you just some pertinent Minnesota facts. If you're on following the presentation on page 3, of the presentation is a real simple perspective of the natural gas supply chain. And it really is very simple, and like electric, we can get a little bit more complex. Here we simply are taking gas out of the ground in some portion of the United States and then transporting it to Minnesota via interstate pipelines. And then it's turned over to a natural gas company like CenterPoint Energy, and we turn it over to our customers. On slide 4, we talk about that there is no native supply in Minnesota. I suppose we all hope it wouldn't be bad in today's world if we could annex North Dakota, so we had the advantage of natural gas supplies here in Minnesota, but we do not, unfortunately. So we are required to get our natural gas from elsewhere, and we transport our gas from the southern part of the United States, Canada, and the western United States. Slide 5, just give you a quick picture of where some of the major natural gas basins are across the United States. For CenterPoint Energy, we get most of our gas we get about 40% of our gas out of Canada. We get the rest of our gas out of the Anadarko Basin down in the Oklahoma Panhandle, and some of it out of the Rocky Mountains. As I stated earlier, natural gas has to get here somehow, and that's by interstate pipelines. These pipelines are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And in Minnesota, we have four pipelines that we can take natural gas off of. We actually have five pipelines in the state. If we turn to page 7, just gives you a quick picture of what these interstate pipelines look like across the United States. You can see where they start coming together in some of the major basins. And this is, again, regulated by the federal government, and we have to basically reserve space on these pipelines to get gas transported here to Minnesota so then we can then turn it and sell it to our customers. Slide 8 is a little rougher picture, but it is a picture nonetheless of the major pipelines that cross Minnesota that deliver natural gas. All of these pipelines are deliver natural gas that we can actually take off and give to our customers. Alliance Pipeline is a pipeline that goes right through Minnesota, does not stop, it goes to Chicago. It carries what's a wetter type of gas that, for instance, they strip off the propanes and natural gas down Chicago and take advantage of that here down Chicago, and we're not able to do that here in Minnesota as of right now. So that once the gas gets transported in Minnesota on these interstate pipelines, it then turned over to distribution companies like CenterPoint Energy. And page 9, I just share with you some of the things that a natural gas company does in Minnesota. There are 6 investor-owned utilities in Minnesota, and there are 34 publicly owned distribution companies in Minnesota. And so what do they do? What we do is we acquire the gas, we arrange for the transport in the interstate pipelines, we then put it into our main services and put it through to our meters to our customers. We bill our customers, and then just we maintain the system. So those are the things that the local natural gas company does. Page 10 just gives you, for future reference, the 6 major investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota that deliver natural gas in the major community that they serve. Slide 10, for your future reference, gives you the publicly owned gas utilities by municipality. And then I'll conclude, Madam Chair, with slide 12. And it really is a summary of the slide I went over first that went over the distribution chain. And it shows the revenue dollar for a natural gas utility. You'll see on the upper left-hand quadrant a section of this pie chart that's called utility distribution charges. Those are the charges in our revenues to cover our cost of serving our customers for our mains, our services, our payroll cost. It works out to be about 25% of the bill, a customer's bill, is to cover our distribution costs. And those are the costs that would be regulated by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission in the context of what you may have heard called a general rate case. The other sections of this pie chart that were in tan are cost of gas, and they're regulated by the Public Utilities Commission also, but they're passed through the purchase gas adjustment. The smaller tan slice is the interstate pipeline costs. Those are the rent costs that cost us. We have to rent on the pipelines to get the gas here to Minnesota. The larger tan slice are the molecules themselves. This is what the customers burn to make energy. And that, Madam Chair, is really where I need to hand off to Mr. McGill because he's here to address that larger tan slice of the pie.
Thank you, Mr. Dougherty. Before we begin, Mr. McGill, I think there's some questions. Senator Magnus.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been looking at this a little bit in the context not only of natural gas but propane and anhydrous ammonia also. And you did mention a little bit that one of the pipelines that goes through the Alliance Pipeline is a wet natural gas pipeline and doesn't stop here in Minnesota. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more. One of you could talk a little bit more about the wet natural gas and the shipment of that and the location of that and why we don't do any wet gas here. And pull off the propane and the other things because we've got a little bit of use for propane here in the state of Minnesota. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that, if you would, please.
Madam Chair and Senator, I will readily admit I'm not an expert on the Alliance Pipeline. I do think there may be a representative of the company here, and maybe they want a chance to answer your question directly. I will say that it requires a significant amount of capital investment to be able to strip the liquids in the natural gas away and then put it back into the pipe. And I think it probably will come down to economics and how that's done. But other than that, I can't answer your question much more than that.
Well, Madam
Senator Magnus,
and again, we've had some periods of time where we've been overwhelmed by pipeline or propane demand, especially in some cases anhydrous ammonia too. But
We've had several years in a row where we needed to have the governor request an exemption, a waiver from the federal rules of in-hour service time at these terminals because they were backed up so far with demand that the trucks, by the time they would get up to actually load their trucks at the terminals for propane specifically, they were not able to load the truck, and because they didn't have enough in-service time to go, they would count the time they waited in line for that. And so we, for several years in a row, we had asked for waivers from the federal rules that govern this, which is not a practice that we'd like to continue doing. And there's been a lot of concern about a propane supply and movement and infrastructure. In fact, I had the Ag Committee request the Department of Ag do a study last year on the supply and demand for propane and anhydrous ammonia because of this. And I know that the wet natural gas that you were talked about, you know, has that in there. And maybe we should look a little more, Madam Chair and others here in the committee, look a little more about that situation where, you know, if we've got this pipeline moving through here, maybe we ought to look at some of the situations with that. Because I do know this, too, also last year that the one of the propane pipelines going under the Missouri River broke under the river, and we had a real problem. Thankfully, we had dry crops, didn't have to dry those. Thankfully, we've had a warm winter, not big demand for that. But a couple years ago, we had a perfect storm of propane demand and just overwhelmed everything.
Sure.
And so I think we need to look at how we position ourselves for the future, Madam Chair, and when these situations hit, it'd be wise for us, I think, as Energy and Ag Committees to look at that and have some thoughts in mind and some ideas on how we can avoid these storms here, perfect storms for propane. Thank you.
Mr. McGill, can you or Mr. Doherty answer some of these questions or shed some light on that?
Specifically, again, to your question, I would reiterate high BTU gas is natural gas, methane, CH4, with other constituents. And for the average home consumption or even some of the industrial burner tips that require specificity around the BTU content, the interstate pipeline system is set up to meet those requirements. So that the high BTU gas does have to be stripped. There is, of course, an investment element that goes into that and a business decision that's made around it, and that's typical around the country. So the fact that gas moves relatively unprocessed, you know, towards the Chicago market is I agree with you, there is an opportunity there, but it is a very much an economic question as to whether it can be done locally.
And Senator Magnus, I think what we'll do is let Mr. McGill go through his presentation, and there is someone in the audience with the Lions perhaps can come up, and we'll address the rest of those questions.
Be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGill.
First of all, it's wonderful to be here. I occasionally get into state capitol buildings. This one is as beautiful as many of them are, and really look forward to the opportunity to talk with you. The fact that we have maybe even as much of an hour to discuss these elements means that we can really peel the onion back on some of these questions that you have around natural gas nationally. I began my career in the exploration business and have worked on the production side, along with my experience with AGA, and if I can answer a question, I will do so. If I can't, I'll certainly say so. And Madam Chair, I am happy to start into the presentation. For me, it goes and would be much, much better. You don't really need to hear a prescriptive presentation from me. I'm really here as your resource. I want to answer your questions, so stop me at any time. Just to set it up a little bit, natural gas in the United States is about a quarter of the total energy that we consume in the U.S. In 2010 and 2011, the country consumed about 24 trillion cubic feet. Here in Minnesota, you consume, well, there's 50 states, 24 divided by 50. You consume about 400 BCF annually, something in the 20 to 60 billion cubic feet per month range, which arithmetically is about average for the country. There are larger consumers. There are smaller consumers. The thing about natural gas and about natural gas demand and consumption around the country is that it's not specific to just one sector of our economy. Natural gas serves residential, commercial customers, industrial customers at their burner tips, even feedstocks, power generation, even to some extent as a transportation fuel. So natural gas is already very pervasive in our energy economy around the country. And what you're going to find out through my presentation is I am very optimistic about natural gas, not only as what you may have heard in the past as a bridge to the future, but really a foundation for energy in the United States. I noted the amount of natural gas that goes to electricity generation, and I've included a slide for 2011 that shows that power gen. We typically think of natural gas as a fuel that peaks for consumption and historically has peaked for price during the winter heating season. But if you follow pricing trends today and even going back a number of years, that really has not necessarily been the case. We have a new peak period for natural gas demand. It's not quite as high as that in the winter. But during the summer, there is a summer peak for natural gas going to electricity generation. And if you look at the pattern of pricing for natural gas going back the last decade or so, we can often find the highest price for gas in the middle of July rather than February. So the marketplace has changed. That five-month cycle of the winter heating season really is now another five-month cycle of the summer cooling season, and that has impacted the marketplace greatly. Perhaps the thing that we will end up talking about the most today goes to the next supply, and that is natural gas supply sources. The United States is the largest natural gas consumer in the world. The United States is the largest natural gas producer in the world. The United States and Russia, by far the largest producers in the world. Here in the U.S., with the advent of the unconventional resources we've seen developed over the last 5 years, our domestic supply has been a bigger part of what has served consumers. Today, about 98% of the gas we consume comes from North America. In fact, domestic production has gone from less than 50 billion cubic feet per day in January of 2007 to about 63 billion cubic feet today, a 25% increase or more. And that's extraordinary. I started in the E&P business in the late 70s during the Carter administration. And for those of us here that remember that, we were running out of everything, particularly hydrocarbons. I was a raw geologist. Texaco, who I worked for, had a plan not of sending you away for a couple of years for technical training, but they just threw you into the mix. And ladies and gentlemen, I was a moron, and I kept finding natural gas wherever I look. That's happening again today. The situation, the reasons are different, and we can discuss those. Methane is a very common molecule in North America, and we are seeing the technology to get that gas out of the ground. The end result has been in the last 5 years that our resource base, our consumption of natural gas is a decidedly more domestic supply. And it appears to me that it's going to continue to stay that way. The next slide explains a little bit about what we're seeing in the current market today. I just took a weather prognostication for mid-January or late January, and the whole country was expected to be warmer than normal. Currently, nationally, going back to October 1st, we're running 14% warmer than normal around the country, which is an extraordinary number. We're going to end up top five warm winters of all time. And that's part of what we were seeing around the market today, and is certainly one of the reasons that we have seen the relatively low prices compared to history right here in the middle of the winter heating season. Not only the strong demand, strong supply position, but a very, very moderate demand around the country. The next slide touches on working gas and storage. Just as I said, we're the largest consumer of natural gas in the world. This country produces more natural gas than any other country in the world. This country also has the largest storage system of any country in the world by far. And underground storage generally can account for 15 to 20% of the gas that we consume as consumers during a winter heating season. So it becomes very regionally, and as far as meeting peak winter heating season demand, extremely important. And along with the recognition of the production, of the storage, ladies and gentlemen, we have the largest pipeline system, integrated pipeline system in the world, in this country also. Over a million miles of pipe, over 300,000 miles of large, long-line transportation, interstate, here in the United States. It's an extraordinary set of assets that we have here already in place. And part of my message to you today as we discuss this, and certainly part of my optimism, is gas is now. There's no heroic assumptions going on here. The increases we've seen in production are real. The assets in the ground to deliver gas are tangible and real. And they have been growing as the natural gas industry required it. As I noted before, we've seen lower prices around the country. In 2011, natural gas prices below $3 currently here, right in the middle of the winter heating season. In fact, I looked a couple of weeks ago in one of the biweekly reports I write, natural gas was below $3 per million BTUs. For the prompt month forward price, the February price of natural gas. It was below $3 for natural gas at Henry Hub. It was below $3 for natural gas at the New York City Gate. Extraordinary. This is Econ 101. Strong supplies, modest demand.
Mr. McGill, how long has those prices been at that level or at below the average level?
Well, we've seen a transition actually from, if you remember, mid-2008 was an extraordinary period for natural gas pricing, and you can argue about what caused that, whether it was supply-demand fundamentals or whether it was the financial market. Through 2009, we had some economic downturn. 2010, prices have continued to fall through 2011. They're as low today as they have been in a decade. So we have seen this pricing situation really for the last 24 months, and it's been only declining. I think the marketplace right now is waiting for it to firm up and to move up a little bit because, as I'll discuss a little bit as we go on, in terms of balancing supply and demand, a $2.50 per MMBTU price for what we are doing in the field today is not rational. It's more than likely going to have to increase. But it's not just the supply elements. I've been trying to make the case that the demand elements are part of that also. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, one of the other things that we've seen, and as I've noted in the slide titled U.S. Gas and Crude Oil Prices, at an MMBTU value, liquids and gas prices historically essentially tracked one another. They have diverged from one another. Natural gas prices are low. Are in that below $3 range right now, certainly. An equivalent MMBTU dollar value for a barrel of oil today is about $17 per barrel. So gas prices today are a fifth, maybe even a sixth in some cases, of what had been a compatible pricing framework for liquids in the past. Those have diverged. And the analytical community seems to believe that it's going to stay that way, not necessarily because natural gas prices may not move up or down a little bit, but I don't see a lot of hope in the analytical community that we're going to get away from $100 oil very soon. So this situation is going to exist for, and many people believe, still years. So,
Mr. McGill.
Yes, ma'am.
I just got to ask you this. What's the Henry Hub spot and the WTI spot? Does anybody else know around the...
Okay. Oh.
Am I the only one?
No, ma'am. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Henry Hub is a physical location in Louisiana where a large number of pipelines come together. It tends to be the marker, if you will, for natural gas pricing around the country. Many contracts are written such that you start with a Henry Hub price and build your transportation costs, et cetera, from there. So it's a market hub. It's an area in which buying and selling occurs, so market prices are made there. But they're also made in Opal in the West. They're made in the East at various places, too. But the futures price for NYMEX is set at Henry Hub. So it's kind of the de facto pricing point for gas in the country.
Or Senator Magnus, don't tell me you knew that.
Thank you, neighbor. We are neighboring districts, by the way, in the heart of agricultural land and renewable energy. But what could you explain to us a little bit more about the marketing and the contracts and what size of contract is available on the futures trading and maybe a little bit of the background on that, if you could, and, you know, the size of the market, and is that expanded, and how far out can you buy contracts, this sort of thing? Can we give us just a little bit of background?
Well, I can give you a little flavor for it. Futures trading is, of course, a promise to take delivery, but many of the financial instruments that are traded around futures prices, physical delivery is never taken. It is a place to establish a pricing point to build off of. When our local gas utilities build a gas supply portfolio, as Jeff noted in the pie chart that you saw, there is a commodity cost. Then there are transportation costs, where they make reservations on pipelines to move gas from point to point. There's also storage locations where physical gas supplies can be obtained. But looking back at the Henry Hub and looking at the financial tools that give us a sense of natural gas pricing going forward, you're looking at a market that has the potential to contract years in advance based on a futures contract. I'm not aware of many companies that go more than 24 months in advance, but their ability to build a supply portfolio is just that. It is contracting for various periods of time, contracting from various suppliers, contracting using the physical storage tools as well as the financial tools that they are permitted to use in their regulatory environment. It is truly a portfolio approach to bringing gas to consumers and making an effort to guarantee the best price that they possibly can. Jeff, would you like to comment on that at all, or is that accurate?
Madam Mr. Chair, Chris very much well captured it. And for us, when we take a look at hedging our portfolio, you know, we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket, which I think it's the same as if you look at your 401k plan. You don't want to put your 401k plan all in one basket. Our major objective when we hedge our natural gas portfolio is for market stability and to get stable prices, not to speculate on price as much. So we have long-term contracts, we have short-term contracts, we have daily contracts, and we have to have those not only for guaranteed supply, but also to manage the supply. I mean, when it's 20 below in Minnesota one day and it turns to 10 above the next day, you can imagine there's a significant supply shift, and you can't have too much of your eggs in one basket. So we have to manage the diversity of our portfolio, and that's why we look at it as a diversity.
And what, Madam Chair, what size? How? What size is a contract? In the cost of that?
Madam Chair, Senator, and Crystal, correct me if my memory is serving me correct. I believe a contract in the futures market is, I believe, 10,000 MMBTUs is a minimum contract to be purchased. I will say that natural gas utilities such as CenterPoint Energy, we have a number of ways to hedge our portfolio. We don't necessarily have to depend upon the futures market to do that. We can do it also in the physical market, and we can go out and get physical arrangements with other gas suppliers to buy gas in the going forward at a such and such a price. So we can do it without using the financial market, and under those types of terms, we're not necessarily limited by 10,000 MMBTUs.
Mr. McGill.
So, Madam Chair, why the optimism? And essentially, what has happened recently, really in the last 10 years, what has materialized in the last 5 years. I have two slides. Wave hello to where we are going and marketed natural gas production. When I started in the business in the late 70s, generally I drilled for targets in the Gulf of Mexico and West Texas and the Appalachian Basin, drilled vertical wells, and drilled for targets that may have been hundreds of acres in size, tens of acres in size, and looking for a unique reservoir. In a very real sense, what originally sourced those reservoirs over geologic time were fine-grained, organic-rich rocks, many times shales, and over the period of geologic time, the hydrocarbons that were in them migrated into these other reservoirs. It was a process where finding the gas or oil was very difficult, very exploratory in nature. Producing it was very easy because generally the rocks were very porous and good permeability, terms that are used to describe natural gas reservoirs. Today, what is being drilled are the source rocks. In the Marcellus Shale, in the Fayetteville Shale, in the Haynesville, what's being done today is producers are drilling down to the shales, those original source rocks, using horizontal techniques, the completion technologies that we see today, and we're actually producing from the source. Now, the interesting thing about this is that these reservoirs are not unique, a few hundred acres here and there reservoirs. They underlie states. They're enormous in their distribution and their size, counties and states, thicknesses. The volume of gas in place is almost unimaginable. It's the technology today that allows these things to be recovered both economically, technically, and environmentally. And those are probably some of the questions that you're going to have. But I wanted to set that up because it's not that nobody knew where these were. It's simply that they were not producible. They were not technically recoverable 20 years ago. And today they are. And this is what has pushed the revelation. The other critical thing about this is these are not located on the North Slope of Alaska. This is not remote. These are rocks that sourced rocks that have been drilled before. So they are in places where there's infrastructure. And the reason we've seen 12, 13, 14 BCF per day of production increases in this country is this gas can get to market. Small tweaks here and there, it gets hooked up into the grid and the gas is flowing. And so it's been an immediate resource for natural gas to the country and to the pipeline grid. I have a diagram of a horizontal drilling fracking operation, and the next slide shows a fracking operation in western Oklahoma. Take a look at those. Mm-hmm. Remember the last time you read something about natural gas and about hydraulic fracturing? What can we talk about? What can I help you with in understanding this?
Well, Mr. McGill, how is the What are some of the concerns of the industry, of EPA? And it does seem to be controversial.
Okay.
So just tell us what the EPA is doing to address some of those concerns, what they are, and how EPA is addressing some of those concerns in the industry itself.
Okay, well, we'll start at the beginning. Shale rocks, low porosity, very impermeable, a lot of gas saturation, but it doesn't move very quickly. It took hundreds of millions of years to get where it got to where it was exploited before. A producer doesn't want to drill something and wait 100 million years for it to produce. So they have to stimulate the reservoir. To do that, they use large volumes of water, sand, and some chemicals, and horsepower. You create a surface signature by having to bring in trucks, mixers, build pits, all of these kinds of things to create this industrial process in order to fracture the rock sufficiently or to enhance the natural fracturing that is already there to allow the gas to flow in the reservoir back to the surface. And to do that, you not only have to pump fluid under pressure, but you have to carry what's called a proppant. And generally, it's sand. You have to create the fractures, and then you have to hold the fractures open. It's really kind of neat when you think about it. Under really thousands of pounds, a couple thousand pounds of pressure generally, you can break down a rock formation. You can push sand out into the formation. You can create enough of a pathway for the gas that is in the rock to then migrate in economic volumes back to the surface. And as I noted, to do that, that requires water, it requires chemical, it requires management of those things at the surface, and it requires all of the production elements that go on also that lead to the potential for fugitive methane emissions and those kinds of things. That is what the Environmental Protection Agency is concerned about. However, let me just note first that virtually all of these drilling operations are regulated, by the states. And I've included a couple of slides in here that shows the things that they currently examine and regulate. There is an organization called Stronger. That is the State Review of Oil and Natural Gas Environmental Regulations. It's a group that goes around to the states and it does an audit of their regulatory structure for managing their natural gas production and their oil production. And these are some of the things that you see in those audits that the states are doing. And I tried to pull the things out that seem to be common among the state regulatory outlook. Casing and cementing plans, issues around the chemical constituents, containment vessels, water management plans, disposal plans, surface reclamation, well complete, all of these things today are managed by the states. What EPA is looking at to see within, under the auspices of the Clean Air Act and the Safe Water Drinking Acts, whether there is a requirement from a federal level to manage these elements also. And that process is going on. The Environmental Protection Agency currently does have a hydraulic fracturing-centered study that is going on. They are collecting data currently. A final report, there will be interim elements that come out, but a final report I do not think is due until 2014. But beyond those things, there are certainly other agencies, the Bureau of Land Management, that are examining these practices and examining the oil and gas operations in the states individually or in the regions where they are. And there is the public discourse, some of it factual, some of it not. It's certainly there. And regarding that, again, if there are any specific questions that you have, I would love to try to answer them as best I can.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McGill, with regard to the sand and the water and the chemicals, they're put in to facilitate the extraction. Are they pulled out as part of a recovery process or as part of the process of getting the gas?
It depends on the geology of the formation that is being treated, Senator. In some cases, what you put down, literally 70 or 80% of it comes back. In other cases, 30% of it comes back. The formation can act like a sponge. One of the critical elements around water management is, if, as you can imagine, if you put a fluid down a hole and you force the fluid out into the formation and you bring it back, it's not only just what you put in it, it's what comes back, the dissolved solids and everything that come back to the surface from the formation itself. So there are many things that need to be examined and managed. The surface elements are managed such that those produced waters are normally captured. In a number of areas like Pennsylvania, for example, the standard is to recycle as much as possible those fluids that are returned. In other cases, the fluids are aggregated and they're taken to locations where there are deep disposal wells, industrial disposal wells into saline aquifers, essentially. In Pennsylvania, for example, there are very few of those wells, so where there is transport of the fluids for deep disposal, the fluids are generally taken to Ohio, and that's part of the cost of doing business. It's one of the reasons why recycling is a very cost-effective solution in Pennsylvania for managing these waste fluids. So there are numerous ways to manage these things. The water is originally acquired, again, depending on where you are. In Pennsylvania, most of the water resources are surface resources. In Texas, the water resources tend to be underground resources. So it differs regionally. It's one of the reasons why the natural gas industry, and AGA in general also, has been supportive of the state regulation of these things, because they tend to be very localized, depending on whatever the geology is, whatever the hydrology of the area is.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you. I was making notes while you were talking, sorry. So, when you're listing here, chemical constituents, listing and management, I'm working out in North Dakota, and my background is water recycle and reuse. And when we're dealing with frack chemicals, and I will even go back to tell the group here that everything is localized, and even these frack fluid mixtures are localized to whatever kind of shale you're working in.
Yes, sir.
But we can't get chemical listings. The oil industry folks will not give us the listings of what they're putting in the frack fluid, so it's very difficult to design water recycle systems. So if they're listing it somewhere, I'd kind of like to know where they're listing it. And in Pennsylvania, I've done a good deal of study of what's going on in Pennsylvania, and I can tell you they're doing a crappy job of recycle out there. They're running a lot of that frack fluid into wastewater treatment plants, which will not produce a good quality recycle water. So we're getting to the point where it's not rocket science. There's a lot of ways to do this, and it's very cost-effective to do this. But since all these are different and they should be locally regulated, why can't I, as a designer for these systems, get these chemical listings and look at these things as to how we can fix it?
That process is changing. For example, the state of Texas, beginning February 15th of this year, requires a complete, transparent divulge of the chemicals that you put down into a frack system. There is an online system called Frack Focus, which is managed by the Groundwater Protection Council, that is in the process of trying to create a nationwide database where those chemical constituents are identified, and that literally a landowner or a person would be able to go well by well and see what's been put in. It takes time for that to come up to speed. Your example of North Dakota, I'm not certain of where North Dakota's laws and regulations are around that. I do know that the industry in general is embracing this notion of transparency and disclosure. John Deutsch from MIT conducted a study through the Department of Energy around natural gas and around hydraulic fracturing. And I think he said it best when that study was concluded in November of 2011. Test. Go to these places and find out what the groundwater content is now. Find out what the air quality is now. Do the basic science before you drill. And then he said, disclose. Whatever you find, shout it from the mountaintops. Tell everybody what you found. And then whatever needs to be mitigated, do what you have to do that. That's the only way this continues to get done. And the industry is moving, and I'm speaking for the producer industry here, although AGA represents local gas utilities, they are moving in that direction. And actually, the examples of what companies are doing to engage stakeholders and to deal with these things, in my view, from what I read and see, are much less present in the popular press than the issues that are discussed. It's not standing still. This is a real economic opportunity for these companies, and they have to do it right to continue to do it.
Senator Jungberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McGill, and I agree, it's a real the press isn't playing it out necessarily right in some of these states, and it is very safe and protective of the groundwater. So I'm not concerned there, but in trying to get simple chem panels, so you know, I'm working with designers all over the country, and as you look with whether they're designers or engineers, and we're, you know, to final designs, companies come to us, and you get it all laid out on a nice board, and you say, this is going to work, and you say, well, give us a final chem panel of your produce water or something, for example, and they'll say, well, gee, we don't want to give you that, or as they're fracking, what's the frack fluid stuff? Now, I did make a breakthrough this past weekend. I met somebody from Halliburton that said they will give that up, but that's what's keeping, you know, just to kind of put that out in the public, that's what's keeping a lot of this from actually happening. There's the equipments out there that can do better than what they're doing today and cheaper, and without all the trucks you're showing here, we can do it in a much smaller footprint, but you need to know all these constituents. And as well, folks, we found out this weekend from some of Halliburton's studies, there's a lot of other recoverable minerals in the produce water as it comes out, mm-hmm. not just oil. Mm-hmm. Comes out, you know, part oil, part water. And a lot of North Dakota has rotten water to start with, high dissolved solids. But there's a lot of other recoverable minerals that whether it's manufacturing industry for different electronic parts, whether it's we were working with some people that put together pharmaceuticals, and there's a lot of good minerals, trace minerals that come up with that are harvestable and resellable that way too. But, you know, until we get those kind of chem panels, until they get out there and really put that stuff out there so, you know, other people in industries of the recycle and reuse know what's there and know what they can harvest and know how to make it more economical, you can't really move forward on that.
Well, the local gas utilities in May of 2011 published a set of principles for responsible and sustainable resource development through the American Gas Association, and disclosure and transparency was one of the major elements of that. I agree, and the association agrees with you that is absolutely the direction we have to go.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. McGill, is there any natural gas or oil reserves under this state?
In Minnesota? Or
yes.
No, ma'am.
No?
Okay. No, the geology is your location to the center of the core of the North American continent just really didn't provide for that.
No.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I was going to change the subject slightly, Madam Chair.
That's fine.
So Senator Nelson was going to continue.
Oh, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Kind of to that point, actually, I know we're not on the Marcellus or the Bakken Reserve, but we do have the silica sand that's so important. And there are counties very near my district that are kind of grappling with this issue right now. And you mentioned the economic import that this may have, because my understanding is that silica sand is actually more valuable than the product that's being removed from the fracking. And so I wanted to ask you two things. One, you talked about the recycling of the liquids coming up, which would include the silica sand. And I kind of want to know, if you have a crystal ball, how far along that process you are. And then because the areas near my district that are looking at silica sand are wondering, you know, how can we capitalize on this? It could be a real economic boom, but how do we do it in a safe manner? And I'm also wondering, there's a window of time here, I think, where the silica sand might be so incredibly valuable. So I kind of would like you to address that and what you see as far as the recycling aspect.
Mr. McGill.
With respect to the use of sand, silica, in the hydrofracking operations, you don't have to look any further to your neighbor, to Wisconsin, where there is also a lot of current mining done for the sand in hydrofracking operations. You need a sand that has a relative consistency in its size. If you can remember back to those little science experiments we did where you put big balls in a container and little balls in a container, as long as they were all the same size, you had the same amount of porosity in the jar. You don't want uneven or unequal sized things because they screw up the transportation that you're trying to create for the molecules. So it's a unique opportunity. It's a unique element if you have that in your area. The thing about natural gas shale development, two things I would point to. I believe you're correct. There's a window of opportunity here. Low porosity, low permeability rocks. You don't drain a large area with one well. So techniques are getting better and technology is getting better, but it takes a lot of wells. Back in the mid-90s, the U.S. Geological Survey did an analysis of the resource base here in the state, in the country, and as far back as then, they identified what they called the continuous resource, what I explained to you with the shales, large distribution over large areas. They said at that time it would take a million wells to develop it. They may be right. It may be conservative. So a lot of wells are going to be drilled in order to be able to produce this resource. That's the opportunity. What's the challenge from your standpoint? Technology marches on. Somewhere, when we talk about the environmental elements that go around here, the liquids, the chemicals, and whatever, there's a holy grail out there somewhere where you use less water, less chemicals, and Halliburton is sure trying to figure out what it is, because whoever figures it out is going to make a lot of money. Could that happen with the proppant elements too? Could we see other materials go into the rock? Yeah, it's absolutely possible. I don't know how to predict that. I only know that the technology will advance. Whether that leaves silica behind or whether silica continues to be that proppant source, it's hard for me to say. But is there an opportunity today? Yes, there absolutely is. But again, coming with that kind of surface operation are the controversies and the discussions that go with, you know, is this a viable economic opportunity in our region?
And just one follow-up, Madam Chair. So at this point, there isn't any recycling of the silica sand.
The sand is captured. Some of it is recycled, but a lot of it is buried in pits. And when the pits are covered over, the sand that isn't left in the formation, and the company, remember, is pumping it down there to hold the fractures open, so they want it to stay there. They don't really want it to come back, not the sand portion. That which does come back tends to be buried in the pits that are later serviced and covered up when the area is reclaimed.
Okay, just one more.
Senator Nelson.
So I think I might have misunderstood, though. So actually, the real issue about the window of time for silica sand is not so much in the recycling aspect. It's that there may be something else other than silica sand that can actually serve that purpose.
That is possible.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm happy to hear about the industry statement of principles and would love to see that.
Jeff can provide that for you.
Thanks. That would be great, Madam Chair, Mr. Dougherty. I am admittedly not well educated on the subject of fracking. It doesn't happen in Minnesota. All I know is what I kind of read in the papers and hear on the radio and, you know, I want to be in love with it because it sounds like the second coming is the greatest thing. But then I hear about, you know, the issues that Senator Jungbauer raises, you know, what are the chemicals being used and the resistance to disclose, the resistance to EPA regs and you know, the impact on groundwater and water quality and sometimes surface mm-hmm. water and water quality as well. So anxious to understand better where we are in the state of the science and where we are in the kind of the political and policy realm and moving forward and getting a handle on it so we all can be in love with fracking. I actually have a different question, though. That's about earthquakes. I heard a radio story about earthquakes. What's the deal with that?
Mr. McGill.
Well, again, the my reason to be here is, I think, to talk factually. With respect to hydraulic fracturing, I've described the growth of fractures underground. That's a mini seismic event. Every time somebody fracks a well, that's a seismic event. Those events are not shaking the ground, moving buildings, tumbling bridges. The earthquake events that have been referred to and that we've talked a little bit about here on the side goes more in line with the deep well disposal of fluids. In places like Missouri, where there has been measurement of some enhanced earthquake activity, recently in Ohio, it was centered in an area where there was a disposal well. You're pumping fluid down the well, and in the case in Ohio, there's 125
you like that.
Disposal wells. The earthquake issue that was brought up recently was centered where there were a group of four and centered specifically with one well. And in fact, the subsurface faults in this country are very, very well mapped by the U.S. Geological Survey. That well happened to be in the vicinity at depth of a fault zone, and it's entirely possible that the pumping of those fluids interacting with that fault zone was causing some seismic movement. My solution for that, believe it or not, would be stop doing it. Go someplace else. Yeah. Those things are known. That is a situation that, in my view, can be managed. And the volumes of fluid that were being pumped down that well before were not causing any seismic activity. The enhanced amount of fluid being pushed did. So stop it. Go to one of the other 100 wells that are not in the vicinity of a fault zone. That's where the earthquake activity has been centered around the issues that have been brought up that I've read about publicly.
Thank you.
Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back to an earlier comment, Mr. McGill, about the person who comes out with the best process is going to make a lot of money. And so, you know, I'm just wondering about this sharing of information and sharing of chemicals you know, how is that going to happen if the technology, if somebody has developed a better process, what does that do to the competitive nature if we're just going to share everything, and what does that do to R&D?
Senator, it will eventually happen because stakeholders, regulators will make it happen. It's just not it's a non-starter to say, trust me. It's just not how the industry can move into an area and work anymore, and they found that to be true. Now, are we talking about semantics here, chemical disclosure? Are we talking about the exact amounts of each chemical? Or are we there's probably some level of proprietary information that can be managed, yet still be able to disclose those things in approximate volumes that are going down a wellbore. Whether the companies want to deal with that or not, they're going to have to. That they are being forced to through legislation, legislative acts, as well as regulatory acts. I just don't think that stakeholders are going to permit it not to be so.
Mr. McGill, are there any regulations coming down on the federal side that could be affecting the industry, could enhance it?
Well,
or make it problematic?
Whether it's EPA or a legislative act by Congress, if somebody just indiscriminately said we're going to ban hydraulic fracturing, got it passed through Congress, mm-hmm. and it became the law of the land, then the growth that we have seen in natural gas production would stop. We don't get a molecule of this without it, period. So virtually anything that happens that doesn't have a purpose that can impede the development or the growth or the opportunity to use these technologies can influence the amount of natural gas that we are recovering in the market. Absolutely. Now, what specifically could it be? And ladies and gentlemen, I'm a citizen too. I think there's a right way to do this, and we should do it correctly. The argument right now seems to be whether the state implementations are sufficient. What does the umbrella of a federal presence mean? Madam Chair, that's the point here. It really hasn't been defined yet as to exactly what it would mean, what regulatory elements would a company have to do beyond what they currently do with not only the states, but in the West, where a lot of the land is federal to begin with, dealing with the Bureau of Land Management and all the things that they do right now. So the industry question is, well, what are you getting? What are we getting for this? What goal is it here that isn't already being met by something else? And that's a question that hasn't been answered yet because the federal laws really have not been developed yet. Now, the Department of the Interior has said that on federal lands, Secretary Salazar has come out with this recently, they are pushing this disclosure issue also. So it's gone from the states. It's being pushed out into the federal operations. And maybe by the time it's all said and done, we're not going to have one giant big thing. Maybe the momentum that's been created, it's going to get pieced together, and there will be more of a federal involvement we see than we see today. I'm not certain about that. And one other comment I would make is you see written many, many times that these oil and gas operations are not regulated through the Drinking Water Act or the Safe Air Act or the Clean Air Act, and that is not true. States implement those rules and regulations associated with oil and gas operations in virtually every state in the country. Now, you may argue that we need different ones, different rules or whatever, but this notion that they're just exempt is frankly not true.
And you mentioned that each state has their own set of regulations that are overseen by the EPA. Is that correct?
Well, they participate with the EPA to put some of the national obligations in place. But around oil and gas, the states that have production, and there's been historically, I think, 32 of them, more than half the states have had some kind of production, have oil and gas commissions and other regulatory structures that enforce these rules and regulations. The other group that I mentioned was Stronger. They're a entity that goes around to the states, audits their rules and regulations, and gives them help in bringing them up to speed.
So the states the commissions that are out there are using best practices, and they're trying to develop goals, whether it is to keep natural prices fairly low or to help them help natural gas be a part of the energy mix, whether it's coal or nuclear or wind or solar. Is that correct? Are they? Because you mentioned something about the goals, and I'm a little confused. Is that what is the goal of the industry?
Okay. I'll repeat what I have heard said. I've sat in meetings in Pennsylvania, for example, with state regulators, Lieutenant Governor, and others. The goal in Pennsylvania is to make Pennsylvania relevant again in energy production, to do it in such a way that it is environmentally safe, and do it in such a way that the economic benefits of those things make their way to the people. That's what I hear the regulators
and those people who are elected officials, that's what they discuss. Those are the goals. Using Pennsylvania as an example, again, if you go back 5 years and look at them, they've grown from where they were to where they are today. Senator, you mentioned the disposal of waters into municipal systems. Well, the governor stopped that in May of 2011. The producers are no longer allowed to do that. Now, I'm not going to say that water doesn't make its way into the stream system, but those things, the states learn as they go along. You, more than me, understand that.
Any other questions? Senator Junger.
While we're kind of talking on the wells and stuff, most of my basis is in North Dakota, but you've done a lot of study on Pennsylvania and Texas to come up with some of these ideas too. But in terms of natural gas, when you're dealing with the oil industry and the flare gas, the natural gas that comes along with it, it just seems like there's a lot of that gets burnt off. Is there any way to harvest any of that? You know, if you go from in North Dakota, if anybody ever goes out there, if you go from Stanley down the back highway to Newtown and then to Watford City at night, it looks like a million lighters out there burning all night. You can literally see your way.
No producer wants to flare natural gas. It's economically ridiculous to do it. But to produce the oil when there is no natural gas infrastructure, it's better to flare it from a environmental standpoint than it is to just release the methane into the atmosphere. So you will see flaring in areas until the infrastructure is built to capture that, and there are numerous projects going on to do that. The gas, you know, truly has a real economic value. So it sometimes just takes time, and in the case of North Dakota, obviously the objective are the liquids. So the statement you make is a fair one. It's absolutely true. And building the infrastructure to collect the gas and to move it to markets is in process now.
Well, Senator Jungberg.
Madam Chair and Mr. McGill, thank you again. I guess that was part of the answer, but is there enough flare gas there that it's worth building infrastructure with that many wells to capture it?
Yes. In general, as we examine and look analytically at the future of natural gas in the country, one of the elements that goes with this is this enhanced liquids production. Southwestern Pennsylvania, the Eagle Ford Shale in South Texas, the Niobrara in Colorado and the Rockies Front going up to the Bakken. In producing those liquids, you produce a baseline of associated gas that goes with it. And that's a very, very positive thing on the gas supply side of things. As long as those liquids are being produced, that gas supply is going to be there. And when you begin to add those up, you start getting billions of cubic feet of that associated gas as a baseline portion of the future gas supply in the country. It's actually a very positive thing.
Thank you.
Did you want to continue, Mr.
Yes, ma'am. I certainly
can. And then we're going to bring up Alliance after that. But I do have another question, though, too. The Marcellus Shale is definitely the game changer here. So are we relying too heavily on natural gas? And if this large supply that's coming in, is that going to be able to – are we going to be able to keep the prices low if the demand goes up?
Madam Chair, there's a technical answer to that. There's a philosophical answer, and I'll give you my philosophical answer first. I've been working in the natural gas business and industry since the 1970s. If there's one consistent thing we have done as a public, even on the regulatory and legislative side, it is to underestimate the potential of natural gas in North America over and over again. We're still doing it today, in my view. I do not believe that we are really, truly going to understand the methane endowment here in North America until it gets demanded. That demand pull is part of this process. So whether we're talking about transportation, more natural gas in the transportation sector, power generation, are we depending on it too much? My companies, the local gas utilities, have to buy gas in the marketplace with all of these other players. I believe the whole pie grows if
it is demanded. I believe that we can supply more natural gas to the marketplace at competitive prices with other fuels for decades to come, and that we, until it's demanded, this country consumed 22 to 23 TCF of gas annually for 15 years. It didn't change. The sector demand changed, less to industrial, more to power generation. It's only in the last couple of years that we've seen a slight increase, a couple of BCF per day increase, and yet we've had a 15 BCF per day growth in natural gas production. Still waiting for that opportunity to move more gas into our energy economy. And people may disagree with me on this. That is my point of view and my place where I've come through my career. I still believe that we're underestimating the potential of gas supply.
Do you think it
supply.
Is the transportation sector? Where else?
Well, it has a long way to go. There are 12 million, maybe, natural gas vehicles in the world.
Where? Where are they mostly? All over?
Every other place but here. We have about 140,000. We're way behind the curve there. Many of our local gas utilities are looking at the transportation elements, fleets, and others as another market source for them. Jeff, do you have a comment on that?
Madam Chair, we have some customers in Minnesota, waste management types of organizations are converting their fleets over to natural gas to manage their fleets, and these are fairly sizable operations that are doing that. At CenterPoint, we are interested in having a discussion with this committee and others about how we can promote natural gas vehicles in Minnesota, especially along the lines of removing barriers in place to help promote natural gas vehicles. And that's something that we'd like to advance here next year or two. Okay.
Senator Magnus, tell us what you're...
I've seen this around the world a lot, but in our area, southwestern Minnesota, the Swan Dairy, the Swan ice cream trucks, most of those were running on compressed natural gas. Mm-hmm. So it's out there. And
Madam Chair, absolutely, Senator. That's
I just had to tell you a story. I was riding around in Argentina on a van that had compressed natural gas, and that didn't work so good. It finally quit. And we were about four stories of bridges or overpasses high in downtown Buenos Aires, and that didn't go so good. So. My Spanish isn't much better than my English, so I couldn't get along too well there, getting down off of there.
Any other question, members?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator, really I think what we run into more often than not is this, the upfront cost of conversion, and it's just like any other new technology. There's a lot of cost for putting the tanks in the vehicles, those types of things, the compression. I think that what we're viewing it right now, we're viewing a lot of opportunity, especially in the fleet markets. I think that's where we're going to see most of the opportunity at first. I think for the residential markets, that's going to be down the road for a ways. But we think there's some opportunities here, and I'd like to have more discussion with you all about that.
Well, that would be wonderful. We'd really like that, Mr. Dougherty. Appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question. Do you have any figures on what you think are the tipping point of those costs for conversions and things of that nature?
Mr. Dougherty.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I do, but don't have them with me at the top of my head. I'll be glad to get them over to your office. I wish I could tell you right now. It's a missed opportunity, but we have them back at the office.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, this has been a real pleasure, Mr. McGill. Thank you so much for coming all the way out from D.C. Really appreciate your knowledge and your willingness to inform us on this very important energy source.
I appreciate the opportunity. There's more information here, certainly. If anyone has any questions that I can help with, please contact Jeff, and I would be happy to do so.
Appreciate that. And a big thank you to CenterPoint for making this happen. Mr. Dougherty, really appreciate this.
Madam Chair and Senators, thank you very much for taking valuable committee time giving us this opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think we are going to bring up Alliance real quickly, though, too, mm-hmm. while they're coming up. Senator Nelson.
Oh, I have a question at the end before we adjourn.
Yeah, absolutely.
Regarding the cellulostic ethanol
grants,
and this might not be the time, but I'm thinking there might be the people in the room who could answer my questions at the end of the hearing today.
Okay, absolutely. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I, Mr.
Strachwedine.
Strachwedine. Thank
yes.
you from Alliance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, I'm with Alliance Pipeline. As referenced, we're an interstate natural gas pipeline that transports gas from the Canadian, Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, British Columbia, and Alberta through the state of Minnesota. We operate 252 miles of high-pressure, high-energy natural gas. We refer to it as rich gas or dense phase gas, not wet gas, from the perspective of there is no free liquid in our pipeline. It is all in a gas phase. We're unique in the design in that we operate a 2,500-mile-long truck. We don't own the energy. We simply transport it to the market, regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The high energy that we have includes methane, fractional amounts of ethane, propane, butanes, and pentanes. The reason we were designed the way we were, which is safely operated, regulated by both FERC and the Department of Transportation, Pipelines and Hazardous Material Safety Administration, is to economically deliver that energy from a supply basin, being in Canada at the time, to a market in Chicago. We have a sister company that's not regulated that extracts those liquids, 60 to 70,000 barrels of natural gas liquids, the ethanes, propanes, et cetera, every day out of that gas streams, and then markets them in the Midwest, serving refinery needs, agricultural needs, propane space heating, grain drying, et cetera. So it's a unique model in how we were built. Typically, that processing occurs in the producing areas. Some of that occurs in North Dakota. We're now connected to the Bakken field in North Dakota, bringing very high energy gas down our system into Chicago for processing by our sister company. The rest of the methane gets delivered into the natural gas grid, serving Chicago and the Midwest in general. While we could connect here in Minnesota, we are an open access pipeline by federal regulation. A supplier or producer or service company here wants our gas. They come to us. We work with them to safely construct an interconnection with us to deliver that gas for their needs. They contract with the shipper that owns the gas, and we would make that delivery. Today, we have three delivery points in the U.S., typically ethanol plants that were configured specifically to burn this higher energy natural gas. So it's a matter of a customer coming to us, and we do have a couple of local distribution companies here in Minnesota today in some of the rural areas that are talking with us about an interconnection. The challenge is the cost, obviously, of that interconnection, which they have to bear, and the cost of the energy that we move through our pipe that, again, we do not own. So that's a brief summary of where Alliance is. We have a great track record. We've been operating in the state since December of 2000, every day focused on safe and efficient delivery of natural gas. One last plug, please call before you dig. Dial 811. It's a free call, and the consequences are not free. Thank you.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was looking at the maps that Center Point put out, and I saw that going through here. And I knew we were flyover country, but I didn't know we were piped under country. But I'm trying to sort this out in my mind, how we get from this price of natural gas and, very low levels. And I understand the BTU contents and all this sort of stuff between that and some of the other competing energy sources. But trying to get from that to the point where we're using propane, especially when we're talking about rural areas of the state. We don't have natural gas out to our rural area in many towns, small towns. Certainly don't have it in the rural areas. So we're at the mercy of the propane market or the fuel oil market, and we know what fuel oil prices are. But I'm trying to get my head around how come natural gas is so cheap, and my propane's $2 a gallon yet.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think if you went back to the graph that Mr. McGill had on the oil pricing, which I believe is slide number 7, where you show oil pricing and natural gas pricing, that decoupling, methane has been decoupled from what was traditionally a trading range with tied to oil here in the U.S. Natural gas liquids, propane being a primary component of that, has stayed in the ratio with oil, so therefore it's a higher value. What you're seeing in the producing communities and several producers of natural gas are pulling out of what's called dry gas plays and going to the wet gas or oily gas such as a North Dakota, where they can get higher value components. That's the other reason why Alliance Pipeline is unique. We deliver that natural gas liquid to a viable market. The producers are trying to keep us full because of the bigger premium they get from those NGL plays.
Other questions? Mr. Sharkey. Yeah, we have a session. Thank you so much for coming out, Mr. Sharkey.
Appreciate the time.
This is very interesting. Mr. McGill, thank you again for coming out. It was a pleasure. Members, we have session. Meeting is adjourned.